Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side one of For the Record program number 708, Going Deep with Daniel Hopsicker. This program is being recorded on April 4th of the year 2010, and once again, it is my pleasure and privilege to bring back to our airwaves Daniel Hopsicker, the author of Barry and the Boys, the newly released in a second paperback edition of A Welcome to Terrorland, plus the maven and author of the various articles on the Mad Cow Morning News website, madcowprod.com. Daniel, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Pleasure to be with you, Dave.
I'd like to begin by offering a small apology to both you and the audience for what I consider to be a subpar performance in our last interview, subpar on my part. We did an interview on Super Bowl Sunday in February, and a lot of the articles, a lot of the information that you touched on had not actually been formulated into articles, but I was kind of bouncing along from point of information to point of information as you sort of pull back the dark curtains on many of these startling institutions and individuals. And I just don't think I did all that good a job. I was kind of blown away by a lot of the things you were saying. So I was going, you know, oh, Jesus, and all this, you know, kind of reacting to the information. I just don't think I did that good a job as a broadcaster. So a small conditional apology to both you and the audience. And what I'd like to do in this program is to set that right. I'd like to cover some of the same ground, maybe some new stuff, but I'd like to really lay out the terribly important, remarkably interesting, and very terrifying deep history of Venice Airport. And also, Daniel, I'd like to at times maybe encapsulate certain key things for the audience, because we've always got new people coming in, so that we can catch them up on some of the history, some of the things that you've done in the past, and also some of the broad history of this, because it's a fascinating concatenation that you've been investigating. Before we actually get into the material, tell us about some of the new stuff you've got. Tell us about American Drug Lords. Tell us about your new books. Tell us about your website and what people can get there.
Well, I'm just finishing the new American Drug Lords, which has just been a mammoth undertaking, at least, you know, for me. And it's going to be 2 hours long. And I've poured everything that I have found out since the date was May 10th of the year 2007. And what happened on that date was a plane was busted with 5.5 tons of cocaine in the Mexican Yucatan. And the plane traced back to a company in St. Petersburg, which had used an address at Huffman Aviation. Now, when I was writing Welcome to Terrorland, halfway through, somebody mentioned, well, of course you know about the heroin. And I said, no, I don't know about the heroin. And that was the first time I found out. And this was from Wally Hilliard's former executive jet manager, that one of Wally Hilliard's planes had been busted in Orlando, Florida, with 43 pounds of heroin on board on July 25th, I think it was, in the year 2000, which was precisely 3 weeks after Mohammed Atta had begun training at Wally Hilliard's Huffman Aviation. And that, of course, did not appear to be coincidence when you know, you juxtaposed the fact that Afghanistan is where the heroin came from, and it very clearly looked to me as if somebody with access to the levers of power in the American government had been doing a dirty business with Osama bin Laden before September 11th. And when FBI Director Robert Mueller went on TV in a press conference 1 week after 9/11 and said that the FBI had known that terrorists associated with Osama bin Laden had been training at flight schools in the U.S. and was not asked and did not answer if they had known this, why had they not picked them up? it began to become clear to me that a protected drug activity had allowed Mohammed Atta access to the country, and that this is the global network that British Prime Minister Tony Blair suggested 2 weeks after 9/11 had been associated, but not responsible for the 9/11 attack. So it seemed clear to me, but evidence is not proof. And so while I presented the evidence, and I believe I presented my conclusion, it was too stunning for me, almost even to believe that I'm, even though I've known for years and written a book about the CIA's involvement in the drug trade.
You've written two books about that, really, or two books touching on it. Go ahead.
But still, the idea that activity had in some measure been responsible for allowing the terrorists access to this country, which allowed them to kill 3,000 people, it's just hard to wrap the mind around, Dave. Hard to wrap the mind around.
Dan, let me butt in ever so quickly, because I'm gonna give your brief commercial here, and then we'll get into the substance of this amazing concatenation that you've been pursuing. Daniel's website is madcowprod.com. The actual URL. It's the Mad Cow Morning News. I really think, Dan, you should start calling it the Herd Shot Round the World. It's a catchy little subtitle, and it really is appropriate both on a journalistic and a sort of a power political level. And in addition to the many, many articles and also videos and also Welcome to Terrorland, now out in a second paperback edition, published, by Trine Day. I don't know, you don't have Barry and the Boys available anymore, do you, Daniel?
It's temporarily out of print.
Well, one of the things that is so strong about your work, and it also, at the risk of seeming a little self-righteous, it is something that is also one of the strengths of my own effort, and I'm now in my fourth decade on the air, and that is that there is a progression and an interlocking and intersection between, your work on Barry Seal, who was a CIA officer, former Special Forces operative, whose operations stretch all the way from before the assassination of President Kennedy through the milieu, my favorite word, that killed President Kennedy, right on up through the Iran-Contra scandal, and then when you began doing Welcome to Terrorland and investigating the flight schools through which some of the 9/11 hijackers and terrorists infiltrated into the United States, once again you found evidentiary tributaries running back in the direction of some of the people that you'd come across, some of the elements you'd come across in Barry and the Boys, only this time you were carrying the research forward into another whole series of events. And both of your books not only overlap and intersect with each other, but they also overlap and intersect with the many articles. And I think taken as a whole, which they really are, it is a very, very important window into not only what's going on today and one of the reasons why America's ice cream has turned to horse manure, but it also is a very important view into the deep politics that have brought us to this sorry state of affairs in this country. And so again, www.madcowprod.com, the Mad Cow Morning News, or as I call it, the Herd Shot Round the World. Barry and the Boys, temporarily out of print, but let's hope we can do something about that. And also, Welcome to Terrorland and many articles going forward as we speak, as well as videos that overlap the books, overlap and intersect with each other, and which, if properly used, might enable some of us here in the United States of America to reclaim that heritage, which has become so very badly bastardized over the years. Daniel, I titled this broadcast Going Deep with Daniel Hopsicker because in one of your most recent articles, the deep history of the Venice airport, I mean, you have other articles, from hedge funds to handcuffs, and the ultimate hedge talking about Venice Airport's deep, deep history. It goes, as do so many things, all the way back to the Second World War and even events at the very beginning of the Second World War. And I'd kind of like to do a little bit of a timeline and carry this forward because, there's that expression, think globally, act locally. And in a way, that kind of applies to the little old Venice Airport. Venice is a wonderful little community in Florida, retirement home, a retirement epicenter. And I don't know, do you think it would be fair? I've never been there, actually. I know people whose parents have retired there as well as yours. Do you think it would be fair to describe it as a sleepy community, or is that sort of just a worn cliche?
Well, it's more than sleepy, Dave. The big event in town is the early bird special, which starts at 4:30. I mean, it's I lived in Los Angeles most of my adult life, and my parents retired to Venice, Florida, back in the late 70s, early 80s, and I would fly out to see him, every year, spend 4 or 5 days there. And if on the third or fourth day I was there, I had gotten restless enough to need to go out and have a beer that evening, there was no place to go and nothing to do. The average age is 69. It's the second oldest population in the entire United States in Venice, Florida. And it's a lovely little town. And I never noticed... This doesn't say anything particularly about my observational skills. Never noticed a damn thing wrong with the place, or askew, should I say, until 3 months after 9/11. Well, I mean, 4 days or 3 days after 9/11, actually, when I became aware, to my horror, that three of the four terrorist pilots had learned to fly at the Venice Airport. And I went, nah, this can't be right. This can't be right. There is absolutely nothing in Venice, Florida, to recommend it to a 30-year-old man, even if he's a terrorist. If you're about to spend the last year of your life, and you have the choice between Fort Lauderdale and Venice, Florida, there's no choice to be made there. So the idea that these people had come of their own volition to Venice, Florida, struck me as absurd before I ever began to dig into it, because there's nothing in Venice for anyone like that. Absolutely nothing in Venice. And then, of course, as we found out, these people acted more like lieutenants in an Arab drug cartel than they did like pious Muslims. They drank, they did cocaine. Muhammad Atta loved pork chops, okay? Muhammad Atta loved pork chops. His American girlfriend told me. So there we are,
And also we should in briefly interject that there were a lot of Germans, Wolfgang Boringer, people from Austria, Switzerland, and although you've taken a lot of heat for talking about that in one of our visits a year or two ago, there was an article in the LA Times in November of 2001 where a guy who had been a roommate of one of the hijackers, and he was taking a lot of heat, and he was saying, hey, how about all these other people, these Germans and Austrians and Swiss? So sleepy little Venice is a way station on this global network. But one of the things I found so remarkable about one of your recent articles, The Ultimate Hedge, Daniel, and we touched on this in February, is that it isn't just a global network, but it's a deep historical entity,
yes,
that goes all the way back to World War II. Now,
yes,
I'd like to set just a tiny bit of background here, and then I'm going to pass the ball to you, because one of the things we were talking about, one of the things that I just was blown away by, and I don't think I did a very good job as a broadcaster / interviewer, that's why I apologized early on, but you mentioned that one of the key people who was involved with the Venice milieu had worked for, I think a General Brady was his name, had worked for Claire Chennault. Now, General Claire Chennault was best known as the head of the American Volunteer Group. That was a group of American aviators who flew P-40s on behalf of the Nationalist Chinese, or the Chinese at that point, in World War II. They were known as the Flying Tigers, and their aircraft had those shark jaws. I always thought of them as shark jaws, actually tiger jaws painted on them, and they were lionized, mixing metaphors, in a cornball movie by John Wayne. But ultimately, and I'm going to hand this over to you in a second, the American Volunteer Group evolved into one of these drug, it helped to spawn, shall we say, one of these controlled, government-connected drug airlines. But a little bit of the deep history, because Chiang Kai-shek himself, Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek and his regime, were inextricably linked with some with this whole thing. It's how when we got involved with Chiang Kai-shek, this sprung naturally from it. Chiang Kai-shek was described by General Joseph Stilwell as basically a fascist. Stilwell referred to him as the peanut. It wasn't a term of endearment, and he said the only difference between Mussolini and Chiang Kai-shek is that Mussolini was better at what he did than Chiang Kai-shek. Some have suggested that perhaps a comparison with Hitler might have been better. Chiang Kai-shek was a fascist dictator. His security minister was a guy named Tai Li, or T. Li, capital T-I, capital L-I. I've never heard it pronounced aloud. He has been described as the Himmler of China. Now, what's interesting is that the actual, obviously, Heinrich Himmler was a head of the SS and a brutal executioner, but the people who did the dirty work, Tai Li's apparatus, which worked on behalf of Chiang Kai-shek, was the Green Gang of Shanghai, headed up by a guy named Tu Yuesheng. And Tu Yuesheng, in addition to being a crime lord, was a major drug trafficker and, for a time, himself a heroin addict. And that was they were the executioners for Tai Li and Chiang Kai-shek. So when Claire Chennault goes to work for these people with the American Volunteer Group, that's basically who they were talking about. And ultimately, after World War II, after the conclusion of hostilities, in fact, the guns had barely fallen silent, the Axis forces in China were being recruited to fight against the communist Chinese, and it's one of the reasons we lost China. There were 90,000 Japanese troops under arms fighting against the Chinese as late as 1947. They just basically switched sides. And there's an interesting thing. One of the intelligence officers attached to Claire Chennault's American Volunteer Group had been involved in attempting to recruit Chinese puppet troops. These were Chinese warlord troops who'd fought with the Japanese but were basically mercenaries, and he was involved in recruiting these Japanese allies to then fight on behalf of the West against the communist Chinese. He tried to, and this was an OSS officer who had worked with Claire Chennault as an intelligence officer. He was crossing Chinese communist lines and got into a beef and was shot dead. And his, quote, martyrdom, unquote, then spawned a bunch of the tone for the Cold War. That guy, Claire Chennault's former intelligence officer, was John Birch, who, of course, lent his name to the John Birch Society. Now, I set this historical background because in your article, your most recent article, The Ultimate Hedge, from March 8th of 2010, you go all the way back to the World War II, early World War II history of Venice Airport, and there's a memorial plaque there, which most memorial plaques are pretty straightforward, but as we've seen in your investigations, Daniel, there's bloody little that's straightforward in the Venice Airport. Tell us about that memorial plaque and the American Volunteer Group, Claire Chennault, and how this entire concatenation that stretched through the decades and embraces the Kennedy assassination, and so many other things. Let's start with that little plaque, and tell us about that and how this in many ways serves as something of a starting memorial to this grim progression of events.
Okay, sure. Well, I looked into the history briefly of Venice when I was doing Welcome to Terrorland and traced it back as far. I mean, the most imposing building in town, which sits one block off the airport, looks like the law firm, you know, the building from Tom Cruise's movie, The Firm, a big colonial, imposing building, had been the headquarters of Jackson Stevens, who, you know, was Jimmy Carter's roommate at the Naval Academy and is rumored to have been present or had a finger in Iran-Contra and CIA drug smuggling through MENA, Arkansas, blah, 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 blah. And that certainly made sense. But the recently, and this was totally a shock, was, you know, despite all the work I've done down there to expose this stuff and bring it to light, when Ponzi fraud schemer Art Nadell got arrested for stealing $400 million worth of people's money, where, you know, and the money is still unaccounted for. They had attempted, the federal receiver in the case, appointed by a bankruptcy judge in Tampa, federal judge in Tampa, had steered the sale of the Venice Jet Center, which used to be Huffman Aviation, which Art Nadell had bought, to one specific outlet, one specific group of people. And that just seemed beyond bizarre, and it seemed clearly to me that there was a human motivation for all this, which was that we were there first. This is our airport, okay? That could be the only explanation for it that I could come up with, because they could have moved whatever activity is still ongoing in Venice somewhere else. So I had to go, well, what the heck is going on here? I mean, trace it all the way back, and that's what I did. And I'd seen this plaque out in front of the Venice airport many times before, and just never like peered too closely at it. And it commemorates the airport's beginnings as the Venice airfield during World War II. And it says, but it calls it the 337th Army Airfield Base. That's the title of the plaque, 337th Army. But there is no 337th their Army Airfield Bases. They never existed. And looking through historical documents in Venice, the Venice Historical Society has something that said that this plaque was donated by a group of people who the Venice Airport Society in 1992, and it was meant as a joke, okay? It was meant as a joke, not explaining what was funny about it, but just saying it was meant as a joke. So,
which is an odd, as you note in your article, it's an odd joke. Who commemorates an historical plaque
with a joke?
As a joke. I mean, that's a weird. That's weird, right?
Well,
there.
Well, there is a 337th something, but it's a 337th fighter squadron, and that's the Flying Tigers. That's designation that they received when they were absorbed into the and that's what I discovered. Okay, Flying Tigers. Okay, mm-hmm. And so let me tell your audience too about how I discovered this because this is interesting. The LexisNexis database, which all newspaper reporters use and I used and have used for a dozen years, has been sanitized. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Articles that were in the LexisNexis database connecting Muhammad Atta to his American girlfriend, Amanda Keller, have disappeared. Okay? Other things I've noticed, but can't call to mind at the moment, have been taken out of the database. That database has been sanitized. But God bless Google, okay? They have recently put old newspapers online. So if you go to one of their many enterprises called Google News Timeline and type in a name, you can get original newspaper articles as they looked in the newspapers going back to the 30s, 20s probably. I mean, you know. So I, using this resource, I began to look up old articles from Venice in World War II, and sure enough, the Venice airfield had a direct connection to China. They were training people for Claire Chennault's effort. And in fact, the Venice airfield was where they trained a Chinese squadron that flew with the Flying Tigers in China during World War II, or the 16th Air Force as it became. So why would they be attempting to both commemorate that and cover it up at the same time? by calling this plaque the 337th Army Air Field Base. Well, I don't have necessarily your broad historical background, and Claire Chennault was just a name to me. So I did research into Claire Chennault. The most recent thing I found, which was amazing, is a first-person article written by the business manager of the St. Petersburg Times, which we haven't gotten into much, but is no more to be believed than almost anything else down there in Florida. But this guy had written an article published back in the early 90s when it was still China was still terra incognita, still new enough, so that first-person articles about traveling in China were you know pretty fascinating. And he had gone for a six-week trip and ended up in that town, and I don't know how to pronounce it, where the Flying Tigers and Chiang Kai-shek based his operations. And he talked about Claire Chennault and his admirable, apparently back in the early days of World War II, when it looked really bad for America, Claire Chennault had provided some of the first indications that perhaps we were not, you know, that we were going to be able to win that war, and the people, the American Volunteer Force had won some battles against the Japanese, and you know, contributed to American morale, and that all seemed good to me. But and it also seemed good to this guy in St. Petersburg Times that wrote the article. But then he said, you know, all of this, of course, was tainted by the drug smuggling that Claire Chennault engaged in for Chiang Kai-shek.
Now, was this St. Petersburg Times all the way back in the World War II era?
No, this was a 91 article.
Oh, okay, right, okay. I was going to say, because that wasn't known for a while. Go ahead.
So, sure enough, you begin to look into it, and Claire Chennault was widely disliked in the American military, and God knows why, but you know, there, it certainly seems to me that his unorthodox methods, he was both, it turns out, both the commander of American Air Forces in the China-Burma theater of operations, and at the same time, he was the head of Chiang Kai-shek's Air Force. So he worked for both the Americans and the Chinese, and of course after World War II he went on to found Civil Air you know this better than I, Civil Air Transport, which became Air America, which ran opium in the 60s, you know, it's probably, you know, where the historical record of CIA drug smuggling picks up. Mm-hmm. Heroin trafficking. Okay.
By the way, Dan, you know who was Chiang Kai-shek's chief of intelligence in this period? A guy named Louis Siefkin. And if that doesn't sound Chinese, it's because he was a Gestapo officer who operated in the Pacific and who had helped to provide intelligence to the Japanese about Pearl Harbor. And one of the people he had run was none other than Errol Flynn, the actor, the famous actor, who was a Gestapo agent and who reported to Louis Siefkin, among others. So then by 43, he was Chiang Kai-shek's chief of intelligence. Give you an idea how really funky these connections are.
Let's bring two more names into this now, okay?
All righty.
And the first name is Colonel Paul Helliwell.
Okay, let's hold that name. Give us the second name, and I'm going to sign off. We're going to roar right into side two. Paul Helliwell.
Paul Helliwell's first name, and the second second name would be, I can't say it, Dave. the cat just got my damn tongue.
Which guy? Which guy? No, isn't General Byrd?
Jay Pritzker.
Oh wow, Jay Pritzker. Woohoo! I didn't see that in the articles. I'd have to go back. I may have forgotten.
Not there, dude. It's not there.
Alrighty. Well, that's excellent.
It's coming.
We're out of time though, so we're going to sign off here, and we're going to roll right back into this on side two. This concludes side one of For the Record, program number 708, Going Deep with Daniel Hopsicker. This has been recorded on April 4th of the year 2010. We're going to be right back with Daniel Hopsicker, and we're going to set forth some of the deep history of the Venice Airport. For Daniel Hopsicker, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.